This is Audible.
Harlequin Audio is proud to bring you Don't You Cry by Mary Kubica, performed by Kate Rudd and Kirby Hayborn. Sunday. Quinn. In hindsight, I should have known right away that something wasn't quite right. The jarring noise in the middle of the night, the open window, the empty bed. Later, I blamed a whole slew of things for my nonchalance, everything from a headache to fatigue, down to errant stupidity. But still, I should have known right away that something wasn't right. It's the alarm clock that wakes me. Esther's alarm clock hollering from two doors down. Shut it off, I grumble, dropping the pillow to my head. I roll over onto my stomach and swim beneath a second pillow to smother the sound, throwing the covers up over my head too. No such luck. I still hear it. Damn it, Esther! I snap as I kick the covers to the end of the bed and rise. Beside me, there are rustles of complaint, blind eyes reaching out to reclaim the blanket, an aggravated sigh. Already the taste of last night's alcohol creeps up my insides, something called a cranberry smash, and a bourbon sour, and a Tokyo iced tea. The room whirls around me like a hula hoop, and I have this sudden memory of twirling around a dirty dance floor with some guy named Aaron or Darren or Landon. Or Brandon? The same guy that asked to split a cab with me on the way home, the one that's still lying on my bed when I nudge him and tell him he has to go, yanking the blanket from his hands. My roommate, I say, poking him in the ribs, is awake. You have to go.
You have a roommate?
He asks, sitting up in bed, yet beset by sleep. He rubs at his eyes, and it's then that I see it in the glimmer of a nearby streetlight that glares through the window and across the rumpled bed. He's twice my age. Hair that looked brown in the hazy burn of bar lights, and under the influence of a healthy dose of alcohol, is now a pewter gray. Dimples are not dimples at all, but rather laugh lines. Wrinkles. Damn it, Esther. I say again under my breath, knowing that before long, old Mrs. Budney from downstairs will be pounding the ceiling with the hard end of her sponge mop to silence the rumpus. You have to go, I say to him again. And he does. I follow the trail of noise into Esther's room. The alarm clock, a droning noise like a cicada's song. I mutter under my breath as I go, one hand dragging along the wall as I make my way down the darkened halls. The sun won't rise for another hour. It's not yet 6 a.m. Esther's alarm screams at her like it does every Sunday morning. Time to get ready for church. Esther, with her silvery, soothing voice, has been singing in the church choir every Sunday morning at the Catholic Church on Catalpa for as long as I can remember. Saint Esther, I call her. When I enter Esther's bedroom, the first thing I notice is the cold. Drafts of frosty November air sail in from the window. A stash of paper on her desk, held secure by a heavy college textbook, Introduction to Occupational Therapy, blows in the breeze, making a raucous noise. Frost covers the insides of the window, condensation running in streams down the panes of glass. The window is pushed up all the way. The fiberglass screen is removed, set to the floor with cause. I lean out the window to see if Esther is there on the fire escape, but outside the world, on our little residential block of Chicago, is quiet and dark. Parked cars line the street, caked in the last batch of fallen leaves from nearby trees. Frost covers the cars, and the yellowing grass, which fades fast, soon it will die. Plumes of smoke escape from roof vents on nearby homes, drifting into the morning sky. The whole of Farragut Avenue is asleep, except for me. The fire escape is empty. Esther is not there. I turn away from the window and see Esther's covers lying on the floor, a bright orange duvet with an aqua throw. Esther, I say as I make my way across the boxy bedroom, hardly big enough for Esther's double bed. I trip over a stash of clothes tossed to the floor, my feet getting tangled in a pair of jeans. Rise and shine, I say as I smack my hand against the alarm clock to shut it up. Instead, I wind up turning the radio on. And a cacophony of noise fills the room, morning talk against the drone of the alarm. Damn it, I swear, and then, losing patience, Esther! I see it then as my eyes adjust to the darkness of the room. St. Esther is not in her bed. I finally manage to shut off the alarm clock and then turn on the light, grimacing as the bright light makes my head ache, the after effects of an overindulgent night. I do a double take to make sure I haven't somehow or other managed to miss Esther, checking under the heap of blankets lying on the floor. Ridiculous, I know, even as I'm doing it. But I do it nonetheless. I check in her closet. I check the single bathroom, my eyes scanning past the prolific collection of overpriced cosmetics we share, tossed at random on the vanity. But Esther is nowhere. Smart decisions aren't really my forte, they're Esther's. And so maybe that's why I don't call the cops right away. Because Esther isn't here to tell me to do it. In all honesty, though, my first thought isn't that something happened to Esther. It isn't my second, third, or fourth thought either, and so I let the hangover get the best of me, close the window, and go back to bed. When I wake for the second time, it's after 10. The sun is up. And all along Farragut Avenue, people scuttle to and from the coffee and bagel shops for breakfast, or lunch, or whatever it is that people eat and drink at 10 a.m. They're blanketed in puffer jackets and wool trench coats, hands forced into pockets, hats on head. It doesn't take a brainiac to know that it's cold. I, however, sit on the small apartment sofa, the color of rose petals, in the living room, waiting for St. Esther to arrive with a hazelnut coffee and a bagel. Because that's what she does every Sunday after singing in the church choir. She totes home a coffee and a bagel for me, and we sit at the small kitchen table and eat, talking about everything from the children who cried their way through Mass, to the choir director's lost sheet music, to whatever vapid thing I'd done the night before. Drinking too much, bringing home some guy I barely knew, some faceless man who Esther never sees but only hears through the paper-thin walls of our apartment. Last night I went out, but Esther didn't go with me. She had plans to stay home and rest. She was nursing a cold, she said. But now that I think of it, I saw no visible symptoms of illness. No coughing, no sneezing, no watery eyes. She was on the sofa, buried beneath the blanket in her comfy cotton pajamas. Come with me, I'd begged of her. There was a new bar open on Balmoral that we'd been dying to go to. One of those chic, low-lit lounge types that only served martinis. Come with me, I begged, but she said no. I'd be a killjoy, Quinn, she said instead. Go without me, you'll have more fun. Want me to stay home with you? I asked, but it was a half-hearted suggestion. We'll order takeout, I said, but I didn't want to order takeout. I was in a new baby doll dress and heels. My hair was done. My makeup was on. I'd gone so far as to shave my legs for the night. There was no way I was staying home. But at least I offered. Esther said, no, go without her and have fun. And that's just what I did. I went out without her, and I had fun. But I didn't go to that martini bar. No, I saved that for Esther and me to do together. Instead, I wound up at some shoddy karaoke bar, drinking too much and going home with a stranger. When I came home for the night, Esther was in bed, with her door closed, or so I thought at the time. But now I can't help but wonder as I sit on the sofa, considering this morning's turn of events. What in the world would make Esther disappear out the fire escape window? I think and I think, but my thoughts only land on one thing. An image of Romeo and Juliet, the famous balcony scene, whereby Juliet professes her love for Romeo from the balcony of her home, which is more or less the only thing I remember from my high school education. That and the fact that a pan barrel makes the best artillery for shooting spitballs. Is that what sent Esther clambering out the window in the middle of the night? A guy? Of course, at the end of that tale, Romeo poisons himself and Juliet stabs herself with a dagger. I read the book. Better yet, I saw the movie. The 1990s adaptation with Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio. I know how it ends, with Romeo drinking his poison and Juliet shooting herself in the head with his gun. I think to myself, I just hope Esther's story has a better ending than that of Romeo and Juliet. For now, there's nothing to do but wait. And so I sit on the small rose-colored sofa, staring at the empty kitchen table, waiting for Esther to arrive home, regardless of whether she spent the night in her bed or crawled out the third-floor window of our walk-up instead. That doesn't matter. I still wait in my pajamas, a waffle Henley and flannel boxer shorts, a pair of woolly slipper socks prettifying my feet, for my coffee and bagel to arrive. But today they're a no-show, and I blame Esther for it, for the fact that this day I'll go without breakfast and caffeine. By the time noon rolls around, I do what any self-respecting adult might do. I order Jimmy John's. It takes a good 45 minutes for my turkey tom to arrive, during which time I convince myself that my stomach has begun to digest itself. It's been a solid 14 hours since I've had a thing to eat, and what with the surplus of alcohol, I'm quite certain I've got the whole stomach bloating thing going on like those starving kids you see on TV. I have no energy. Death is imminent. I may die. And then the buzzer beeps from the first floor, and I rise quickly to my feet. Delivery! I greet the Jimmy John's guy at the door, handing him his tip, a few measly dollars I managed to find in an envelope Esther stuck in a kitchen drawer with the description rent. I eat my lunch hunched over an industrial iron coffee table, and then do what any self-respecting human might do when her roomie has gone AWOL. I snoop. I let myself into Esther's room without a hint of remorse, without a whisper of guilt. Esther's room is the smaller of the two, about the same size as a large refrigerator box. Her double bed spans the room, popcorn wall to popcorn wall, leaving hardly anywhere to walk. That's what $1,100 a month will buy you in Chicago. Popcorn walls and a refrigerator box. I slip past the foot of the bed, tripping over the pile of bedding that's still left on the scratched wooden floors, and peer outside at the fire escape, a collection of ladders and platforms and steel gratings that adheres to Esther's window. We joked about it when I moved in years ago, how she got the smaller room. But by virtue of the conjoined fire escape to her window, she'd be the one to survive a blaze should the entire building one day go up in flames. I was okay with that. Still am, really. Because not only do I have a bed and a desk and a dresser in my room, I have a papasan chair. And the building has never once caught on fire. Once again, I find myself wondering what in the holy hell would make Esther climb out her fire escape in the middle of the night. What's wrong with the front door? It's not as if I'm worried, because really, I'm not. Esther's been on that fire escape before. We used to sit out there all the time, staring at the moon and the stars, sipping mixed drinks, as if it was a balcony, our feet dangling over a repugnant Chicago alleyway. It was sort of our thing, spreading out along the uncomfortable steel gratings of the dingy black fire escape, sharing our secrets and dreams, feeling the lattice grills of the unforgiving metal dig into our skin until our backsides fell asleep. But even if she was there last night, Esther certainly isn't on the fire escape now. Where could she be? I peer inside her closet. Her favorite boots are gone, as if she put on her shoes, opened the window, and climbed outside with intent. Yes, I tell myself. That's exactly what she did. An assumption that reassures me that Esther is just fine. She's fine, I tell myself. But still. Why? I stare out the window at the quiet afternoon. The morning's coffee blitz has given way to a caffeine downer. There's not a soul in sight. I imagine half of Chicagoland perched before the TV, watching the Bears claim another stunning defeat. And then I turn away from the fire escape and begin my search of Esther's bedroom. What I find is an unfed fish, a heaping pile of dirty laundry spilling out of a plastic hamper in the closet. Skinny jeans, leggings, jeggings, bras and granny underwear. A stack of white camisoles folded and set beside the hamper with care. A bottle of ibuprofen. A bottle of water. Grad school textbooks piled sky high beside her ready-to-assemble IKEA desk, in addition to the one that lies on top of it, holding random papers in place. I set my hand on a desk drawer handle, but I don't look inside. That would be rude somehow. More rude than riffling through the items left on top of the desk. Her laptop, her iPod, her headphones, and more. Thumbtacked to the wall, I find a photograph of Esther and me taken last year. It was Christmas, and together we stood before our artificial Fraser fir, snapping a selfie. I smile at the memory, remembering how Esther and I trekked together through mounds of snow to collect that tree. In the picture, Esther and I are pressed together, the boughs of the evergreen prodding our heads, the tinsel getting stuck to our clothing. We're laughing, me with a complacent smirk, and Esther with her gregarious smile. The tree is Esther's, one she keeps at a storage facility down the street, a 10x5 box where, for $60 a month, she keeps old guitars, a lute, and whatever else she can't fit into her pint-sized bedroom. Her bike. And, of course, the tree. We'd gone to that facility together last December on a mission to find that Christmas tree. We trudged through embankments of newly fallen snow, our feet getting stuck in it like quicksand. It was snowing still. The kind of snowflakes that poured down from the sky like big, fat, fluffy cotton balls. The cars that lined the city streets were buried deep. They'd have to be dug out or wait for a 40-degree thaw. Half the city was shut down thanks to the blizzard, and so the streets were a rare quiet as Esther and I slogged along, singing Christmas carols at the tops of our lungs because there was hardly anyone around to hear. Only snowplows braved the city streets that day, and even they skidded along in a zigzag line. Work had been canceled for Esther, for me. And so we plodded to the storage facility to hunt down that small plastic tree to haul home for the holiday season. Stopping in the concrete corridor to do a giddy dance for the security camera, and plunging ourselves into hysterics as we did. We imagined the employee, a creepy, quiet introvert, sitting at the front desk, watching as we danced an Irish jig on screen. We laughed and laughed, and then, when we finally stopped laughing, Esther used her padlock key to let us inside, and we began to search Unit 203. Me prattling on and on about the irony of that number, seeing as my own parents lived at 203 David Drive. Fate, said Esther. But I said it was more like a stupid coincidence. Seeing as the tree was disassembled and stuffed in a box, it was hard to find. There were a lot of boxes in that storage facility. A lot of boxes. And I inadvertently stumbled upon the wrong one, apparently, because when I lifted the lid of a box and exposed a mound of photographs of some happy little family sitting beside a squat home, lifting one up and asking of Esther, "Who's this?" She snatched it quickly from my hand and said point blank, "No one." I didn't really have a chance to see the picture, but still, it didn't look like no one to me. But I didn't push the issue. Esther didn't like to talk about her family, that I knew. While I groaned and griped about mine all the time, Esther kept her feelings on the inside. She tossed the picture back in the box and replaced the lid. We found that tree and lugged it home together, but not before first stopping by our favorite diner where we sat nearly alone in the vacant place, eating pancakes and sipping coffee in the middle of the day. We watched the snow fall. We laughed at people trying to drag themselves through it or excavate their cars from pyramids of snow. Those who were fortunate enough to dig themselves out called dibs on their parking spots. They filled them with random things, a bucket, a chair, so no one else would park there. Parking spots were like gold around here, especially in winter. That day, Esther and I sat in the window of the diner and watched this, too. We watched our neighbors lug chairs from their homes to stake a claim in the scooped-out parking spots, ones which would soon fill again with snow. feeling grateful all the time for public transportation. And then Esther and I carried that tree home, where we spent the night prettifying it with lights and ornaments galore, and when we were done, Esther sat crisscross applesauce on the rose-colored sofa and strummed her guitar while I hummed along. Silent night, jingle bells. That was last year. The year she bought for me a pair of woolly slipper socks to keep my feet warm, because in our apartment I was cold 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I could hardly ever get warm. It was a thoughtful gift, an attentive gift, the kind that proved she'd been listening to me as I complained time and again about my cold feet. I look down at my feet and there they are, the woolly slipper socks. But where is Esther? I continue my search for what I don't know, but I find stray pens and mechanical pencils. A stuffed animal from her childhood days, ratty and worn, hides on the shelf of a piddling closet whose doors no longer run on the track. Boxes of shoes line the closet floor. I peer inside, finding every last one of the pairs to be sensible and boring. Flats, loafers, sneakers. Absolutely nothing with heels. Absolutely nothing in a color other than black or white or brown. And a note. A note tucked there on top of the IKEA desk in the stash of paper beneath the occupational therapy textbook, among a cell phone bill and a homework assignment. A note. Unsent and folded in thirds as if she was on the verge of sticking it in an envelope and placing it in the mail, but then got sidetracked. I put the cap back on the water. I pick up the pens. How was it that I never realized Esther was such a slob? I muse over the thought. What else don't I know about my roomie? And then I read the note because, of course, how could I not read the note? It's a note, which is all sorts of stalkerish. It's typed, which is such an anal retentive St. Esther thing to do, and signed, All My Love, with an E and a V. All My Love, E.V. Esther Vaughn. And that's when it hits me. Maybe St. Esther isn't such a saint after all.
Alex. One thing should be clear. I don't believe in ghosts. There are logical explanations for everything. Something as simple as a loose light bulb, a faulty switch, a problem with the wiring. I stand in the kitchen, swallowing the last of a Mountain Dew, one shoe on and one shoe off, stepping into the second of the black sneakers, when I see a spasm of light from across the street. On, off, on, off. Like an involuntary muscle contraction. A Charlie horse. A twitch. A tick. On, off. And then it's done. And I'm not even sure if it happened anymore, or if it was just my imagination playing tricks on me. Pops is on the sofa when I go, his arms and legs spread out in all directions. There's an open bottle of Canadian whiskey on the coffee table, Gibson's finest, the cap lost somewhere in the cushions of the sofa, or clutched in the palm of a clammy hand, probably. He's snoring, his chest rattling like an eastern diamondback. His mouth is open, head slung over the arm of the sofa so that when he finally does wake up, hungover, no doubt, he's sure to have a kink in his neck. The stench of morning breath fills the room, exuding like car exhaust from the open mouth. Nitrogen, carbon monoxide, and sulfur oxides flowing into the air, making it black. Not really, but that's the way I picture it anyway. Black, as I hold a hand to my nose, so I don't have to smell it. Pops wears his shoes still, a pair of dark brown leather boots, the left one untied, frayed laces trailing down the side of the sofa. He wears his coat, a zippered nylon thing the color of spruce trees. The stench of old-school cologne imparts to me the details of his night. Another pathetic night that would have gone scores better had he thought to remove his ring. The man has more hair than a man his age should have, cut short, and yet bushy on the tops and sides, a russet color to tag along with the ruddy skin. Other men his age are going bald, thinning hair or no hair at all. They're getting fat, too. But not Pops. He's a good-looking guy. But still, even in sleep, I see defeat. He's a defeatist, a calamity much worse for 45-year-old men than love handles and receding hairlines. He's also a drunk. The TV is on from last night, now playing early morning cartoons. I flip it off and head out the door, staring at the dumped home across the street where I saw the light coming just a few minutes ago. On, off. It's a minimal traditional home, school bus yellow, a concrete slab in place of a porch, aluminum siding, a busted roof. No one lives in that house. No one wants to live there any more than they want to have a root canal or an appendectomy. Many winters ago, a water pipe froze and burst, or so we heard, filling the inside with water. Some of the windows are boarded up with plywood, which some of the wannabe gangs defaced. Weeds choke the yard, asphyxiating the lawn. A rain gutter hangs loosely from the fascia, its downspout now lying defunct on the lawn. Soon, it will be covered with snow. It isn't the only house on the street that's been abandoned, but it is the one everyone always talks about. The economy and the housing market are to blame for the other rotten, forsaken homes, the blight that abraded the rest of our home's value and made a once idyllic nave now ugly. But not this one. This one has its own story to tell. I ram my hands into the pockets of a gray jacket and press on. The lake this morning is angry. Waves pound the shores of the beach, sloshing water across the sand. Cold water. It can't be more than 35 degrees. Warm enough that it hasn't thought to freeze, not yet anyway. Not like last winter, when the lighthouse was plastered with ice, Lake Michigan's swell frozen midair, clinging to the edges of the wooden pier. But that was last winter. Now it's fall. There's still plenty of time for the lake to freeze. I walk a body length or two away from the lake so my shoes don't get wet. But still, they get wet. The water sprays sideways from the lake, the surf a solid 4 or 5 feet high. If it were summer, tourist season, the beach would be closed down, dangerous swimming conditions and rip currents to blame. But it's not summer. For now, the tourists are gone. The town is quiet, some of the shops closed until spring. The sky is dark. Sunrise comes late and sunset early these days. I peer upward. There are no stars. There is no moon. They're hidden beneath a mass of gray clouds. The seagulls are loud. They circle overhead, visible only in the swiveling glow from the lighthouse's lantern room. The wind whips through the air, upsetting the lake, making it hard for the gulls to fly. Not in a straight line, anyway. They float sideways. They flap their wings tenaciously and yet hover in place. Going absolutely nowhere, like me. I pull my hood up over my head to keep the sand out of my hair and eyes. As I crisscross the park, heading away from the lake, I pass the old antique carousel. I stare into the inanimate eyes of a horse, a giraffe, a zebra, a sea serpent chariot where a half dozen years ago I had my first kiss. Lee Forney, now a freshman at the University of Michigan, studying biophysics or molecular something or other, or so I heard. Lee isn't the only one who is gone. Nick Bauer and Adam Gott are gone, too. Nick to Caltech and Adam to Wayne State, playing point guard for the basketball team. And then there's Percival Allard, a.k.a. Percy, off to some Ivy League school in New Hampshire. Everyone is gone. Everyone but me. "You're late," Pretty says, the sound of a bell overhead tattling on my overdue arrival. She stands at the register, counting dollar bills into the drawer. 12, 13, 14. She doesn't look up as I come in. Her hair is down, tight curls of silver rolling over the shoulders of a starched, no-nonsense blouse. She's the only one in the room who's allowed to have hair that is let down. The waitresses who beetle around in their black and white uniforms, filling salt and pepper shakers, bowls of creamer, all have theirs tied back in ponytails or cornrows or braids, but not Mrs. Pretty. I tried to call her Bronwyn once. That is, after all, her name. It says so right there on her name tag. Bronwyn Pretty. It didn't go so well. Traffic, I say, and she sniggers. On her ring finger is a wedding band, given to her by her late husband, Mr. Pretty. There's speculation that her incessant nagging was the cause of his death. Whether or not it's true, I can only assume. She has a mole on her face, right there in the sallow folds of skin between the mouth and the nose, a raised mole, dark brown and perfectly round, which always sports a single gray hair. It's the mole that makes the rest of us certain Pretty is a witch. That, and her maliciousness. There's rumors that she keeps her broom in a locked storage closet off the kitchen of the cafe. Her broom and her cauldron, and whatever other Wiccan thing she needs. A bat, a cat, a crow. It's all there, tucked away behind a locked metal door. Though the rest of us are sure we hear them from time to time. A cat's meow. The crow's caw, the flapping wings of the bat. At this time of day? Pretty asks about the traffic, but on her face, there's a smile there somewhere, under the peach fuzz that seriously needs to be waxed. She compensates for it somehow, for the peach fuzz, by drawing eyebrows on, dark brown on hair that is meant to be gray, to take the attention off her stash. Pretty pauses a moment in her counting to raise her eyes up off the dollar bills, as I stand there in the entryway stripping off my sandy jacket, and she says to me, "Those dishes aren't going to wash themselves, you know, Alex. Get to work." I think she secretly likes me. The morning comes and goes as they always do. Every day is a rehashing of the day before. The same customers, the same conversations, the only difference is a change of clothes. It goes without saying that Mr. Parker, who walks his two dogs at daybreak, a border collie and a Bernese mountain dog, will be the first to arrive, that he'll tie the dogs up to a street lamp outside and ramble inside, the soles of his shoes leaving leaf clippings and muddy footprints before the display case, which I'll later be called upon to wash away. That he'll order coffee, black, to go, and then let Pretty talk him into some kind of pastry, which erroneously claims to be homemade, which he'll say no to twice before he says okay, sniffing the air for the faint scent of yeast and butter that isn't even there. It goes without saying that at least one waitress will spill a tray full of food, that nearly all of them will gripe about the inadequacy of the tips, that on the weekend, the morning customers will loiter around, drinking endless cups of coffee and shooting the shit until breakfast blends into lunch, and they finally leave. But during the week, the only customers hanging around after 9 a.m. are retirees, or the school district's bus drivers who double-park their bluebirds in the back lot and spend the morning kvetching about the disrespectful nature of those in their care, namely, all children between the ages of 5 and 18. There are no unknowns this time of year. Every day is the same, unlike in the summer months when random tourists appear. Then it's a crapshoot. We run out of bacon. Some egghead wants to know what's really in the chocolate croissants, leaving Pretty to send one of us to drag the box out of the trash and back and see. Vacationers snap photos of the cafe name in the front window. They take pictures with the waitresses as if this is some kind of tourist attraction, a hot spot destination, spouting on and on about how some Michigan travel guide claims ours is the best coffee in town. They ask if they can buy the cheap mugs that bear our name in an old-style font, and Pretty will up the price from the bulk fee she pays, $1.50 apiece, to $9.99. A rip-off. But none of this happens in the off-season when every single day is a rehashing of the day before, the same of which can be said for today, and tomorrow, and yesterday. At least that's the way the day sets out to be, as Mr. Parker arrives with his two dogs and orders a coffee, black, to go, and Pretty asks him if he'd care for a croissant, which he says no to twice before he says okay. But then at the end of the morning, something happens, something abnormal, making this day different than all the days before.
My dearest, it's one of the last memories I have of you, your arms clinging to her neckline, the gentle curve of her breast pressing into your skin through the thin cotton of a wispy white blouse. She was beautiful, to say the least, and yet it was you I couldn't take my eyes off of. The shimmer of your skin and the radiance of your eyes, the gradual curve of your lips as she traced over them with the pad of a forefinger and then placed her own to yours. A kiss. It was through the window that I saw you. I stood there in the middle of the street, not hiding in the shadows or behind trees, smack dab in the middle of the street, impervious to the flow of traffic. I'm surprised she didn't see me, that she didn't hear the blare of a car horn suggestion that I move, recommending it. But I didn't move. I couldn't be bothered. I was too busy watching the two of you gathered together in a warm embrace. Too intrigued and too angry. Maybe you did. Maybe you did see me, but only pretended not to see or hear. It was nighttime, just after dusk, as I pressed my face now to the glass to see inside. The curtains were open. Every single light in the house on, as if you wanted me to see, as if you were gloating, rubbing it in, exulting in your victory. Or maybe that was something she came up with all on her own, leaving the lights on so that I could see. It was, after all, her victory. Like a spotlight illuminating dancers on stage, the way you laughed, the way she smiled, no one noticing my absence because I'd already been replaced, as if somehow I'd never even been there in the first place. Except that you weren't on stage at all, but rather in the living room of a home I was meant to share with you. I have to know. Did you see me? Were you trying to make me mad? All my love, Evie.
Alex. Her hair is dark brown, sort of. A dark brown that lightens steadily so that by the time your eyes reach the end of it, it's nearly gone blonde. Ombre. It's got a subtle wave to it, an understated wave. So you're not really sure if it's a wave at all, or if it's just wind-blown, the hair that sits below the shoulders. Brown hair to accompany the brown eyes, which, like the hair, seem to change colors the longer I stare. She arrives alone, holding the door for a couple of old fogies who follow on the heels of her overpriced Uggs. She steps back and waits while they're seated, though it was clearly she who arrived first. She stands there in the entranceway, somehow looking sure and not so sure all at the same time. Her stance is that of aplomb, upright posture, nothing fidgety or twitchy, simply waiting her turn. But her eyes are aimless. I've never seen her around here before, but for years now I've been imagining she would come. When it's her turn, she's seated at a table beside the window so she can watch the same predictable customers who come and go and come and go, though it goes without saying that they're anything but predictable to her. I watch as she slips from a black and white checkered peacoat. There's a marled black beanie on her head. She removes the hat and drops it on an empty brown banquette chair beside her canvas bag. Then she peels a knitted scarf from around her neck and drops that, too, on the chair. She's petite, though not like those uber-skinny models you see on the fashion magazines and the grocery store lines. No, not like that. She's not pin-thin, but her build is slight. More short than tall, more skinny than not skinny. But still not short and not skinny either. Just average or normal, I guess. But she's really not any of those things either. Beneath the peacoat and the beanie and the scarf, there's a pair of jeans with the Uggs. And a hoodie. Blue. With pockets. Outside, day has broken. It's another sunless day. There are leaves on the sidewalk. Brittle, crumbly leaves. What remain on the trees will lose their hold by the end of the afternoon, if the westerly wind has any say in it. It whips around the corners of the red brick buildings, sneaking under a kaleidoscope of awnings, where it lies in wait for the perfect opportunity to snatch someone's hat or steal scraps of paper from their glove-laden hands. There's no threat of rain, not yet anyway. But the cold and the wind will keep plenty of people inside, forestalling the promise of winter. She orders a coffee. She sits by the window, sipping out of the discount ceramic coffee mug, staring out the window at the view. The brick buildings, the colorful awnings, the fallen leaves. You can't see Lake Michigan from here, but people like to sit at the window anyway, and imagine. It's there somewhere, the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. Harbor country, we're called. A string of small beachfront towns just 70-some miles outside of Chicago. 70-some miles that are somehow equivalent to three states and another world away. That's where most of our clientele comes from anyway. Chicago. Sometimes Detroit, or Cleveland, or Indianapolis, but most often Chicago. A weekend getaway because it's not like there's anything to do here that will keep you busy for more than 2 days. But that's in the summer mainly, when people actually come. Nobody comes now. Nobody but her. Our cafe is far enough off the beaten path that where we sit at the far edge of town, the shops and restaurants give way to homes. It's an assorted mix, really. A souvenir shop to the north, a bed and breakfast to the south. On the opposite side of the set street is a psychologist's office, followed by a succession of single-family homes, condos, a gas station, another souvenir shop, closed until spring. A waitress passes by, snaps her fingers before my eyes. "Table two," she says, a waitress I call Red. They're all just nicknames to me. Red, braids, braces. "Table two needs to be cleared." But I don't move. I continue to stare. I give her a nickname, too, because it feels like the right thing to do. The woman staring out the window is building castles in the air, daydreaming. It's a big deal, really, something different happening around here when nothing different ever happens. If Nick or Adam were still around and not away at college, I'd call them up and tell them about the girl that showed up today. About her eyes, about her hair. And they'd want to know the details, whether or not she really was different than the dime a dozen girls we see every day, the same girls we've known since first grade. And I'd tell them that she is. My grandfather used to call my grandmother, also a brunette, though in my lifetime I'd never seen her as anything other than a mass of web-like gray, Capuchetta. The nickname Capuchetta purportedly came from the monks of Capuchin, or so my Italian grandfather claimed, something about the hoods they wore bearing resemblance to the coffee drink, a cappuccino. That's what Grandpa said anyway, when he looked my grandmother in the eye and called her Capuchetta. Me? I just like the sound of it. And it seems to suit this girl well, the modicum of brunette hair, the ambiguity that surrounds her like the hood of a monk's cowl. But I'm not a coffee drinker, and so instead, my eyes drop to her narrow wrist, where there sits a pearl bracelet that looks much too small for even her small hand. It's pulled taut, the elastic cord showing through the creamy beads. I imagine it leaves a red imprint along the skin. The pearl beads are worn along the edges, losing their sheen. I watch as she plucks habitually at the band, pulling the elastic up off the skin and allowing it to snap back again. It's mesmerizing, almost, that simple movement. Pluck, pluck, pluck. I watch for a while, unable to shift my eyes from the bracelet or her fluid hands. And that's what cinches it. Not Capuchetta, I decide. I'll call her Pearl instead. Pearl. It's then that a cluster of churchgoers appear, the same ones who arrive every week about this same time. They claim their usual table, a rectangular slab that seats all 10. They're delivered carafes of coffee, one half-calf, the other leaded, though no one asks. It's assumed, because this is what they do every Sunday morning, cluster around the same table, talking passionately about things like sermons and pastors and scripture. The waitress braids disappears for 3 consecutive smoke breaks, so that when she returns, she reeks of a cigarette factory, her teeth a pale yellow as she dribbles another inadequate tip into the pocket of her apron and moans, $1.50, all in quarters. She excuses herself and heads to the restroom. The cafe takes on a vibe of normalcy, though with Pearl in the room, the lady with the ombre hair staring out the window at the colorful homes and the red brick buildings across the way, things are anything but normal. She eats from the plate of food now set before her, scrambled eggs with an English muffin on the side, smothered in butter and strawberry jam, a second cup of coffee splashed with 2 tubs of creamer and sprinkled with a single sugar substitute, the pink stuff, which she drinks without ever bothering to stir. I find myself staring, unable to take my eyes off her hands, and she raises the mug to her lips and sips. It's then that the sound of Pretty's thin, metallic voice summons me by name, interrupting my thoughts. "Alex," she says to me, and as I turn, I see her long, crooked finger draw me to her side, her fingernails painted a cantaloupe orange. Before Pretty, on the display case, is a cardboard box and a plastic cup, complete with fountain drink. Inside the box are a BLT with a mountain of fries and a pickle on the side. Same as always. We don't do deliveries, but for Ingrid Daub, we do. And today, it's my turn to go. Usually I look forward to the trips to Ingrid's home, a break from the mundane routine of the cafe, but today isn't one of those days. Today, I'd rather stay. "Me?" I ask stupidly, staring at the box, and Pretty says, "Yes, you, Alex. You." I sigh. "Take this to Ingrid," Pretty says to me, with no please and no thank you, but rather an edict. "Go!" I loiter a fraction of a second, my eyes on the woman with the ombre hair, Pearl, as Red passes by and refills her coffee mug for a 3rd time. Pearl has been here for an hour now, maybe 2, and although she finished her meal long ago, she doesn't go. The dishes have been cleared. It's been a good 30 minutes since Red placed the check on the table beside the coffee mug. The waitress has asked 3 times if there's anything else she needs, but the girl only shakes her head and says no. Red is getting antsy, eager to gather up another measly tip that she can complain about as soon as Pearl decides to split. And yet she doesn't split. She remains at the window, gazing out, sipping coffee with no apparent plans to go. I tell myself I'll hurry, that I'll be back before she leaves. Why? I don't know why. For some reason, I want to be here when she goes, to watch her put the black hat back on her head, obscuring the ombre hair, to watch her wrap the scarf around her neck and gather the canvas bag in her hands, to see her slip into the checkered pea coat, to see her rise up off the chair, to see which way she goes. I tell myself I'll hurry. I'll be back before she leaves. I say it again. If I time it just right, maybe she'll be leaving just as I return, back from my delivery to Ingrid. Maybe. I'll hold the door for her. I'll say to her, have a nice day. I'll ask her her name. New to town? I'll say. Maybe. If I time it right. Also, if I'm not being a chicken shit, which I probably will be. I don't bother to put on my coat for a quick trip across the street. I grab the box and the drink and slip through the glass door backward, using my backside to open the door for me. The wind nearly swipes the box from my hands as I step outside, and I think it's times like these that I wish I had hair. More hair. Much more hair than the burr cut on my head, which does nothing to keep my scalp and ears warm. I could use a hat, too, and my coat. Instead, I wear my cafe-issued attire, the cheap pleated pants, the white button-down shirt, and a black bow tie. It's tacky, the kind of thing I'd prefer not to have to be seen in public in. But pretty gives me no choice. The sleeves of my shirt flutter in the breeze, the wind getting trapped beneath the polyester, making it puff up like a parachute or a birthday balloon. It's cold outside, the air temperature reaching no more than 40 degrees. The wind chill is another story. The wind chill, also known as the one thing everyone will be talking about for the next 4 months to come. Only November, and already meteorologists are calling for a cold winter, one of the coldest on record, they say, with sub-zero temps, record wind chills, and bounteous snow. It's winter in Michigan, for God's sake. What else is new? Ingrid Dobb lives in a Cape Cod right across the street from the cafe, a small Cape Cod circa 1940 or 1950-something. It's a light blue house with dark blue shutters, a roof almost as tall as it is wide. It's a good house, a charming house, quaint and idyllic, save for the hustle and bustle of the main street, which does anything but hustle or bustle this time of year. It's quiet. From Ingrid's upstairs dormer window, she has a bird's-eye view of the cafe, and there I see her, standing in the window like an apparition, eyes watching mine as I wait for a passing car, and then scamper across the street. She waves at me through the glass. I return the wave, and watch as she disappears from view. I start climbing the steps of Ingrid's wide, white front porch, and that's when I hear the high-pitched squeal of a squeaky door hinge, followed by the slamming of a screen door from the home next door, a blue cottage converted into an office for Dr. Giles, the town shrink. It's been less than a year since he moved his practice in. As I peek over, there he stands in the doorway, saying goodbye to a patient before peering up and down the street, hands in pockets, as if waiting for someone else to appear. Does he hug her? I'm quite certain he does, an awkward one-armed hug not meant to happen in plain sight. That's what makes it weird. He checks his watch. He looks left, he looks right, up and down the street. Someone is late, and Dr. Giles doesn't want to be kept waiting. He seems miffed that he has to wait. I see it in his squinty eyes, in his vertical posture, and the way his arms are crossed. I don't like the man one bit. The patient who leaves thrusts a hood up over her head, a fur-lined hood on a thick black parka, though whether it's for warmth or privacy, I can't say. I don't know. I never do see her face before she scurries away, down the street the other way. I don't see her, but I hear her. Half the town hears her. I hear her crying, a distraught wail that can be heard a half block away. He made her cry. Dr. Giles made the girl cry. Add that to the list of reasons I don't like the guy. There was a whole scandal when Dr. Giles moved his office into the tiny blue cottage. A scandal because the ladies in town took to lurking around the cafe, to puttering up and down the street, so they could see the comings and goings of Dr. Giles's clientele, which of the town's members was seeing the head shrinker, and why. Proving what people hated most about small-town living. There is no such thing as privacy. Ours really is the paradigm of a small town. We've got one stoplight, and we've got a town drunk, and everybody knows who the town drunk is. My father. Everyone gossips. There's nothing better to do than throw one another under the bus. And so we do. Ingrid opens the door before I knock. She opens the door and I step inside, wiping my shoes on the woven floor mat. She smiles. Ingrid is about the same age my mother would be if my mother were still here. Don't get me wrong, my mother's not dead, though sometimes I wish she was dead. She's just not here. Ingrid has one of those short hairdos 40- or 50-year-old women sometimes have, the color of wet sand. She has welcoming eyes. She has a nice smile, but a sad smile. There isn't a person in town who could say a bad thing about Ingrid, but rather the bad things that have happened to Ingrid. That's what they talk about. Ingrid's life is the definition of tragic. She's gotten the short end of the stick, that's for sure, and as a result, she's become the town's charity case. A 50-year-old woman too terrified to step foot out of her own home. She has panic attacks any time she does, chest pressure, trouble breathing. I've seen it with my own two eyes, though I don't know her whole story. I make it a point not to meddle in others' business, and yet I've seen Ingrid get loaded into an ambulance and whisked off to the emergency room when she thought that she was dying. Turned out everything was fine, just fine. Just an ordinary case of agoraphobia, as if it's ordinary for a 50-year-old woman to stay in her home because she's scared to death of the world outside. She doesn't leave her house for anything, not to get the mail, or water a flower, or pick a weed. Within the gypsum walls, she's perfectly fine, but outside these walls is another story. But all that said, Ingrid isn't crazy. She's about as normal as they come around here. "Hi, Alex," she says to me, and I reply, "Hi." Ingrid dresses like a 50-year-old woman should, a bright orange sweatshirt kind of thing, and black knit pants. Around her neck, a locket and chain. In her earlobes, stud earrings. On her feet is a pair of flats. Before Ingrid has a chance to close the door, I turn around for a quick peek. There in the storefront glass, I see her. Pearl, obscured in part by the reflection of nearly everything on the opposite side of the street. What's inside and what's outside are complicated by glass, so it's no wonder that birds fly headlong into it sometimes, plummeting to their deaths on the porous concrete. But still, through the marquee of trees, and in the manifestation of half the world on one pane of glass, I see her. Pearl. Her eyes stare out the window, but not at me. I follow the path of Pearl's eyes to a sign that hangs with scroll brackets from the neighboring home. Dr. Giles, Ph.D., licensed psychologist. And there he stands, Dr. Giles, with his dark, trim-cut hair and well-groomed style, waiting impatiently for a patient to appear. Well, I'll be. She's watching him. Does she have an appointment with Dr. Giles? Maybe. Maybe that's it. My perception shifts, but not so much that I stop thinking about her hair or her eyes, because I don't. In fact, they're there every time I so much as blink. Ingrid closes the door, and she asks of me, "Can you lock it?" Ingrid's home is on the small size, but more than adequate for a single occupant as I kick the door closed, turn the deadbolt, and bring Ingrid's lunch to her kitchen table. On the marble countertop is an open cardboard box, a small reserve of novels set beside it. Something to pass time. There's a knife set there, too, a professional-grade carving knife, used to slice through the packaging tape. The television is on, a small flat-screen TV that Ingrid doesn't watch, though I can tell she's listening to it, and my guess is that the sound of actors and actresses on the TV screen tricks her into feeling like she's not alone, that someone is here, even if they're only make-believe. It's a spoof she plays on herself. It must be lonely, not being able to leave your own home. The house is otherwise quiet. Once upon a time, there was the sound of boisterous children and stampeding feet, but not anymore. Now those sounds are gone. "I was hoping you'd do me a favor, Alex," Ingrid says, drawing my eyes away from a lady on the TV screen. Her home is a crisp white, white walls, white cabinets. The floors are a contrast to the rest of the home, stained plank flooring, so dark they're almost black. Her furniture and decor are austere, shades of neutrals and gray, not much in the way of knick-knacks or accessories, unlike my own home. Pops, being the hoarder that he is, unable to part with anything. It's not like he collects years' worth of rubbish, piled miles high in the middle of our living room, stray cats procreating in every crevice of our home so that it burgeons with feral kittens, some living, some dead. No, not like that. Not like those hoarders on TV. But he is sentimental. The type that has trouble parting with my junior high report cards and baby teeth. I suppose this should make me feel good. Deep down, I guess it does. But it's also a painful reminder that Pops has no one else in this world but me. If I were to leave, where would he be? "I made a shopping list," Ingrid says, and without waiting for her to voice the words, "Will you go?" I say, "Sure thing. Tomorrow okay?" And she says that it is. From a window in the kitchen of Ingrid's home, I've got a decent view straight to the inside of Dr. Giles's office. Ingrid's Cape Cod sits just above his, the window at the ideal angle to see right in. It's not a great view, but still, it's a view.